Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Housing and banking, the jewelry store down on the corner. The financial crisis hit them all. So today on the program, the legacy of Lehman Brothers 5 years on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 12th of September, and this is the Marketplace podcast for said date. There is a corny and quite lame joke to be made here about setting up our lead story in 140 characters or less, but I am not going to do that. I'm just going to read you the first part of a tweet from Twitter this afternoon. That would be Twitter, the company. Quote, "We have confidentially submitted an S-1 to the SEC for a planned IPO." So that. Quina Kim covers technology for us. Hey, Quina.
Hey.
So this is a big deal. Why now with Twitter? We've been waiting for this forever.
Well, I think part of the reason is that, you know, they've gotten about over $1 billion of investor money. And at some point, those investors want their money back, right? So There's that. And then there's a tipping point where I think if you raise enough money that you're going to have to start making a lot of things public anyways. So if you're going to have to do that, then you might as well just go public and try to make more money.
Well, let me ask you then about that whole disclosing things and opening the books and making money. I'm going to quote from their tweet in which they announced this thing today. They said, "We have confidentially submitted an S-1 to the SEC for a planned IPO." That word confidentially, what does that mean and what are they doing?
Well, there's this thing called the Jobs Act, and that's allowing companies to go public by only releasing a certain amount of information.
Yeah, this was the president's thing from earlier this year, right? Or it went into effect earlier this year.
Yes, exactly. And this sort of gives them a little time, like 3 or 4 months or however long it might take them to file this IPO, to maybe not give over so much information about what's happening. And as you know, like 3 to 6 months in internet life, you know, is a lot more, it's almost like dog years. It's a lot of time that they can start putting more of the pieces together, maybe trying to ramp up their numbers a little bit more. It just buys them more time.
Okay. Finally, when you go public, the supposition is you are going to make money. You're going to be able to generate profits and dividends for your investors. How then is Twitter going to do that in this medium that, you know, doesn't really give itself the splashy advertising?
Doing all right with the advertising. I think their revenue is supposed to double to about $583 million this year. So, you know, it's not like huge amounts of money, but it seems like they are making more and more money. I think they wanted to hit a $1 billion mark. A lot of their money is coming from what the second screen advertising is what their second screen advertising is what they're calling it. So what that means is, you know, as we're watching the football game, people are talking about it on Twitter. If you're watching the Academy Awards, people are talking about it on Twitter. And that stuff is doing really well for Twitter because it's what they're calling real-time conversation. You can sort of feel like you're talking to people as you're watching this stuff if you don't have anybody to talk with, you know, in your living room.
In your living room, yeah. So I guess I'm the only guy who ignores all those promoted tweets, right?
Right. I did a lot during the elections, I have to say, and it was really fun to see what everybody was talking about. And I think they're gaming on people like me doing this for more and more events.
All right. Quina Kim, she covers technology for us. Quina, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
On a Wall Street that is Twitterless for not too terribly much longer, I dare say. A lot of bouncing around in the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the lessons of the past 5 years, maybe the lesson, really, of the days since the demise of Lehman Brothers, is that the financial crisis wasn't just about Wall Street. It was about the whole economy, almost every slice of it. So that's what we're going to do today, the legacy of Lehman Brothers bit by bit.
My name is Jack Tamias. I am the manager at Martinique Jewelers. We've been in business in this location for about 11 years. We are right across the street from Lehman Brothers, now called Barclays. The day that they declared bankruptcy and all hell went loose, we remember seeing a bunch of people just coming out with boxes. They had a picture of Dick Fuld. They were all writing bad messages, angry messages, and it was really a phenomenon. We just saw everybody just got fired, and everybody was just walking out in boxes and saying their goodbyes. You know, we had some sad moments. We've had some customers, good friends, and they came in crying. You know, they were laid off. Unfortunately, it happened in September, so it wasn't a good Christmas year for us. Usually, not just Lehman Brothers, we have other investment banks. They, you know, they get their bonuses, they start buying their Christmas gifts. So it was harder for the first year or so. We used to be more about them. We shifted to more tourist type of products. We used to be more high-lined. Now we've got Pandora, Swarovski, we got more tourist items. Within 2 years, the Barclays employees, former Lehman employees, started coming back and started spending money. We kind of bounced back better than we had before.
Jack Tobias at Martinique Jewelers on 7th Avenue in New York City. You know, sometimes 5 years feels like nothing, and then sometimes, boy, it feels like forever.
Stocks all around the world are tanking.
Lehman Brothers had 26,000 some odd employees, and
somehow we just missed that home prices don't go up forever.
Crisis.
Crazy.
Lehman Brothers going under was the proximate cause of the financial crisis, the thing that got everybody's attention. But deep down, under all the chaos on Wall Street, were a couple of pretty simple things, a house and a mortgage. Too often during the boom, those mortgages were subprime, more likely to be defaulted on, more likely to cause problems, problems that the housing market is still dealing with. For a while after the crash, subprime mortgages all but vanished. And then they came back, as Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
At the beginning of 2007, New Century was the second largest subprime lender in the country, and it needed more office space. So the company signed a pre-lease with the Mickelson, an office building still under construction in Irvine, California.
Before the building was even completed, the mortgage market had started to crumble and New Century basically went bankrupt.
Andrew White is in charge of leasing office space at the Mickelson. He says that when the building opened in the midst of the financial crisis, it was so empty you could see through it at night.
And that was the case really for a lot of buildings in the area.
This area being Orange County. Ground zero for the subprime industry. 5 years after the crash, office parks here are starting to fill back up, but not with mortgage companies. The car company Hyundai now leases the space that New Century wanted. Among the mortgage companies that were operating out of Orange County was First Street Financial, ranked among the top 40 subprime lenders in the U.S. Here's Dan Pearl of First Street.
February of 2007, I laid off a good amount of people and shuttered a very successful company that was still making money, First Street Financial. Why? Because I didn't think the future looked too good.
Today, Pearl has a much more optimistic vision of the future. He founded a new company called Citadel Servicing, which he says is the first subprime mortgage lender in the U.S. since 2007. Though he doesn't like the term subprime, he prefers non-prime.
Maybe you could explain the difference between non-prime and subprime.
Well, yeah, that's pretty easy to do.
It's easy because they're essentially the same. Subprime mortgages were created for people with less than perfect credit scores who couldn't get loans guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. But they were aggressively marketed to people who couldn't afford them, with gimmicks like no down payment and no need to verify income. Lenders collected big upfront fees. Pearl's non-prime loans do go to people with subprime credit, but unlike the old subprime loans, there are stricter rules. For one, the income of the borrower has to be verified now.
We look at everybody's income. We look at their debt in relationship to that income. We look very closely at the property. And if they can qualify under our guidelines, even with some credit dings here and there, we'll in fact make the loan.
Those credit dings mean that borrowers pay a lot to get a loan from Citadel. Upfront fees can top $10,000. Interest rates start at about 8%. But Pearl also requires a minimum down payment of 25%. So far, Pearl has raised $200 million to lend, and he expects Citadel will have a lot of competition in the next year and a half.
And what you're going to find is instead of it being a $200 million marketplace today, this is going to be a several billion dollar marketplace.
Unlike 2006, when anyone with a pulse could get a loan, there are restraints on the growth of the subprime industry. New regulations have tightened credit standards, and that means a safer market than the one of the early 2000s. But it also makes it harder for lower-income borrowers to get a mortgage.
Well, to be blunt, I don't think we want to have a housing market or a mortgage market which favors middle-aged white rich people. You know, we'd like a market that's more diverse, that reflects the population.
Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. And this, he says, is the great balancing act that regulators have to maneuver. How do you prevent predatory lending and still make loans available to first-time buyers with less than perfect credit? Henry Pontell doesn't have the answer to that question, but he's been studying financial regulation and white-collar crime for decades. He says the ultimate cause of the Lehman collapse was incentives that allowed financial company CEOs and managers to make money on loans that were destined to fail.
We should have learned how perverse environments that encourage the heads of firms to take incredibly dangerous risks and sometimes illegal risks is something that the government needs to take seriously.
The regulations that were put in place have made subprime lending safer. But, Pontell says, the bigger problem, the problem of perverse incentives, was not addressed in the regulatory changes enacted after the financial crisis.
And until the government gets it, until policymakers get it, and until people get it and demand that the changes are made in the law, I would predict that we're going to relive these types of debacles every 8 to 10 years.
And, says Pontell, these debacles are not a natural part of the business cycle. It's the way we've structured the financial industry. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up.
The thing I learned the most from making this film is how tough a job it is to be in the shoes of some of these leaders.
It's tough out there for a central banker. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials took off 25 points today, about a 10%, finished at 15,300. The NASDAQ deleted 9 points, about a 0.25%, 3715 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged down 5 points, a 3%, 1683 there. Precious metals took a tumble. Gold Corp sank 6.5%. Barrick Gold lost 5.5%. Yahoo pulled in 1.5%. Today, CEO Marissa Mayer said the number of active users has increased 20% since she took over Yahoo last summer. Bond prices bumped up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.9%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. We'll find out how back-to-school shopping went when the Commerce Department releases retail sales numbers for the month of August. At midnight, you'll be able to pre-order the iPhone 5C. The C stands for colorful and kind of cheap. And a happy birthday to Fiona Apple. The singer and musician turns, well, a lady never reveals her age. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We, by which I mean us and a whole lot of other business journalists as well, have a bad habit. We sometimes say Wall Street as a catch-all for the entire banking system, which is sometimes right, but sometimes misses a nuance or two. One of the slices of the economy that got walloped by Lehman's demise was consumer banking, most notably Washington Mutual. WaMu's seizure by the FDIC 5 years ago was the biggest bank failure this country has ever seen. Kirsten Grind is the author of The Lost Bank. It's about the life and death of Washington Mutual. Kirsten, glad you could be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's funny, you know, Lehman gets all the press for having been the sort of seminal event of the whole mess 5 years ago. And yes, granted, systemically it was. But it just always seemed to me that Washington Mutual, with the size of it and the fact that this was a bank run, man, this was just a good old-fashioned people lining up outside and getting a bank run going, that WaMu was the populist element of this thing.
Right. You know, WaMu was really the Main Street failure, and it was always very surprising to me how little attention it got as well. But it's understandable because it was based in Seattle, and it also came after a whole range of other quote unquote failures, Lehman, AIG, Merrill Lynch being sold. So in a way, it was kind of ignored, but it was a massive failure. And like you pointed out, there was the bank run, which had that element of the 1930s in there as well.
Is what happened to Washington Mutual sort of an argument that the system worked the way it was supposed to work? I mean, a bank got in trouble. The FDIC came in. Depositors were taken care of. I could have used my Washington Mutual ATM card the next day and gotten $100 and everything would have been fine, even though it was owned by JPMorgan Chase.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's what the FDIC would argue and has said repeatedly, that the failure of WaMu was a perfect failure in a sense, because no depositor of the bank was wiped out, right? And that's the main goal of the federal agencies. They don't care as much about investors, and you could argue whether or not that's good or bad, but no depositor was wiped out.
The big memory most of us have of the financial crisis is the TARP and the bailout and all of that. And WaMu, if I remember right, didn't make it that far, right? It never got to the TARP phase of the game?
No, and that was another very big controversy with WaMu. So all its executives had been asking government officials, well, are you going to pass anything in which we could get some help, some bailout? And they were saying no. And then only 6 days later, after WaMu failed, they passed TARP.
That must kill those guys. You kidding me?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, it's interesting talking to executives of that bank and really any financial institution during the crisis. They all have this post-traumatic stress syndrome. Huh. I mean, really. At WaMu, a lot of the executives had been there, you know, 20 years or more. And so it was almost like watching something happened to your child, and they're still very traumatized by it years later.
You know, and this is a much lesser degree, but I was going back the other day and reading old headlines from the Wall Street Journal from that week in September.
Oh,
and
gives you chills,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, you get a little queasy.
It's queasy. I know. It's just amazing when you think about it that all of that happened and that we've actually managed to come through it and the economy is rebounding. So there's some good news in a way. I mean, if you look back on those headlines, I don't think any of us thought at the time that we were ever going to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. But it has been a long 5 years, huh?
It has. Yeah. Yes.
Kirsten Grind is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Her book about Washington Mutual and its demise is called The Lost Bank. It's out in paperback. Kirsten, thanks a bunch.
Thanks so much.
Among the other things that happened back in 2008 was a new venture by celebrity editor Tina Brown and Barry Diller's IAC Interactive, a website called The Daily Beast. It became something of an online destination and was in the news itself after a disastrous merger with Newsweek. Anyway, Brown announced today she is leaving when her contract is up in January, but it's what she's doing next that got our attention. She's calling it theatrical journalism, live debates and conferences, which, it turns out, are becoming the big business for some media companies. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains why.
Because people will pay a lot of money to see Meryl Streep introduce Hillary Clinton.
Here's what happens when I compare myself to Hillary Clinton, which every living American woman my age has done.
That was at last year's Women in the World Summit, a conference Tina Brown founded.
There's money in this business.
Media analyst Ken Doctor with research firm Outsell says most of it comes from corporate sponsors who want to associate with big ideas and big names. They spend 10% of their marketing budgets on events, and media companies watching their traditional ad revenue shrink want a piece of that pie. Elizabeth Baker Keffer is president of Atlantic Live. She says The Atlantic launched its events business about 12 years ago to reanimate an old brand.
We were a bit of an underdog as a small print publication at that point and wanted a way to be able to punch above our weight.
Now, she says, the company does more than 100 events each year, like the Aspen Ideas Festival. Events make up almost 20% of revenue. Evan Smith is editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune, a nonprofit publisher that hosts dozens of live events around the state every year.
It's a fantastic model. Sponsorship pays most of the bills for these events. We'll do $1,200,000 this year in events and sponsorships.
Better than that, he says, an engaged and informed citizenry talking about the big ideas of the time. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
American Airlines' plan to get out from under bankruptcy protection and merge with U.S. Airways has been approved by a federal judge. Catch is that American still has to convince antitrust regulators at the Justice Department that the merger is a good idea. However things shake out, though, you can be certain airlines are still going to be charging fees for everything from checking a bag to scoring an aisle seat. A report out this week said airlines made more than $27 billion on those and other what are called ancillary fees last year. And Marketplace's David Gura explains those fees are pretty much essential.
All right, just a few announcements before we take off. If you want to watch TV during the flight, that'll be $7.99. And if you forgot your headphones, well, you can buy a pair. It's $5. And if you're hungry, maybe you want a bag of chips, some pretzels. They're $3 each.
Henry Hartfeld is a travel industry analyst with the firm Hudson Crossing. He says all these extras, like that window seat you paid $50 for, maybe that extra legroom, well, it's not pure profit, but it can get close.
If you are paying to check your bag, that is going to have a profit margin generally of probably 50% or more.
He says this has happened because most travelers only care about one thing, and that's getting the least expensive flight.
So when we're buying our inexpensive discount tickets, we are at best break even and more likely a money loser for that airline. That's why they're pushing these optional products. It's how they claw money back.
For ultra-low-cost carriers like Spirit Airlines and Allegiant Air, well, this is the business model. It's bare bones. Everything is optional. For other airlines, fees go right to the bottom line. And they've changed how analysts like Robert Mann evaluate an airline's financial health.
Simply looking at fares is not very meaningful anymore.
Used to be the ticket price was 96 to 98% of what you'd pay an airline. These days, the ticket price is just about two-thirds of what a passenger will pay.
Seat backs up, stow your tray tables. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We'd be remiss as we track through the bits of the economy that were changed by the financial crisis if we didn't mention one part of it that had, and still has, a starring role. The Federal Reserve. The central bank has been all over the place the past 5 years, dealing with unemployment and interest rates and pretty much everything in between. Jim Bruce has made a documentary film about the Fed. It's called Money for Nothing. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This is a film, I'm going to guess, that you made in part to explain to people what the Fed's job is, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, here's why I asked that question. It sort of seems like you think the Fed doesn't know what the Fed's job is.
It's an expanding job. It had a smaller role when it was initially established. And I think the Fed itself may be having some identity crises right now in trying to understand what things they should be involved in and what things they shouldn't.
Talk to me for a second about your access to people. You had Janet Yellen on, who's the current vice chair of the Fed. You had Richard Fisher, who's the president of the Dallas Fed, and the guy from St. Louis. Lots of people agreed to talk to you for this film.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, but we did manage to get access to many Fed leaders, current and former, Paul Volcker among them. And, you know, all I can say is I'm very grateful for all the people who did participate in the film. I think it's a real testimony to the institution that it is willing to have its you know, top officials disagreeing with each other in public. That's not very common in powerful organizations, especially in government.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the degree of debate and dissent that exists in the Fed, because, of course, to the layperson and honestly to a lot of business journalists, it's Ben Bernanke said today when he's speaking for this, you know, the entire board of governors of the Federal Reserve. And it's much like he gets to decide all by himself. But really, there are policy debates.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the things that I really learned in doing this film is that there are so many different opinions at the Fed. And, you know, I think especially during the Greenspan years, there was this sense that it was just Alan Greenspan and the Fed is this sort of monolithic, powerful institution. And the Fed said this or the Fed did that. And I think once you get to know these people, you realize there are differences of opinion in all of the top leaders at the Fed and that there's a lot of discussion about what they should do going forward. And I think that's a healthy thing.
What was the most surprising thing you learned during this film? I mean, what really made you say, whoa, hang on a minute?
I think, you know, the thing I learned the most from making this film is how tough a job it is to be in the shoes of some of these leaders at the Fed, especially in recent years. Congress is not doing a whole lot, and the Fed really is the central force in our economy right now. And I think I understand the pressure people at the Fed must feel to try to do whatever they can to improve the situation.
There's a scene in this film where you go out and you do a bunch of man on the street interviews, just a bunch of what we call in radio vox, and you say to people, you know, do you know what the Fed does? And some surprising number of them go, ooh, yeah, no, I don't know. I know I should know, but I don't know.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's kind of scary and surprising and interesting all in the same time.
I think one of the lessons of Fed history is that when American public opinion really swings in one direction, the Fed does follow. For example, in the 1970s, we had very damaging inflation. And at a certain point, people were so fed up with it, they were willing to support Paul Volcker's efforts to stop that inflation. And I think one thing the film is hoping to motivate people to do is to question today's current Fed policies. And maybe if more Americans were questioning the Fed and its impact on their lives, and we might see better policies from the Fed going forward.
Jim Bruce, his film about the Fed and the history of it is called Money for Nothing. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Russian President Vladimir Putin had a piece in the New York Times today, as you might have heard, about Syria and how he sees that whole thing. Which is fine, free press and all that. The interesting bit, though, the Kremlin's American PR firm Ketchum arranged the whole thing. According to ProPublica and Ketchum's latest filings, the Russian Federation paid $1.3 million for Ketchum's professional services for the period ended May the 31st of this year. Mr. Putin, by the by, did not get paid for his labor for the New York Times. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.